Before we start the show, I want to thank the thousands of you, the thousands who have read This Book Will Make You Dangerous. Many of you have told me that the book's unique way of exploring fear, confidence, and purpose has had a lasting impact, that it's much easier for you to get clarity and direction about what really matters and what you want to do in this lifetime. It's also amazing to hear that quite a few of you have read it multiple times and even bought copies for friends. So thank you again. Just in case you weren't aware, I created a free companion video course for the book. And in these videos, I walk you through the big takeaways and practices from each chapter. And I even cover some extra stuff that's not included in the book. Information on how to access the course is in newer versions of the book. And if you own an older version of the book and you don't know how to access the course, just hit me up via the contact form at triplanier.com and we'll get you all set up. And one last thing, if you're one of the thousands who have already read the book, please consider leaving an honest review on Amazon so that others can decide if it's right for them. Again, thank you so much for reading This Book Will Make You Dangerous. And now let's start the show.
You are listening to The New Man Beyond the Macho Jerk and the New Age Wimp. Your host is men's coach and group facilitator, Trip Lanier. He is joined in the studio by the show's producer, Casey Capshaw.
How do you juggle a strong sex drive and your ability to work side by side with women without getting sued? Are women really oppressed by men? And what in the hell does a heavy plow have to do with a split between men and women in the workplace? Seriously. This week, we're talking with the world's leading integral philosopher and brainiac, Ken Wilber. Listen in as he dispels some myths about gender equality while giving us a glimpse into how everything in your life fits together. Welcome to The New Man. Today, we've got the world's leading integral philosopher. Integral philosophy integrates body, mind, soul, and spirit with self, culture, and nature. And that's just a fancy way to say that this guy thinks and writes about everything. He's the author of over 2,733 books. He's the founder of Integral Institute. He's my friend, and he's a total badass. Ken Wilber, welcome to The New Man.
Trip, how you doing, buddy?
I'm doing good. I'm psyched to have you on the show. You know so much, and we could talk about so many things. But this is a show for the new man out there. I thought that we'd chime in a little bit with the intro of Brief History of Everything, which is a book you wrote years ago. But that first passage in there about where men and women are differentiating and moving, where they came from and where they're going, impacted me greatly and how I viewed myself and not just biologically, but culturally, socioeconomically. What I get is that there's a lot changing nowadays, but it's always been changing. Is that what you're saying?
Yeah, one of the things that we have to look at is the role of men and women historically.
Uh-huh.
And if we do that, and we look at not just psychology, but sociology and culturally and biologically, we find several different eras or epochs that humanity has gone through. And the roles of men and women are quite different in each of these epochs. And so it's not that there's a fixed role for men or a fixed role for women, but that the roles of men and women are evolving, that they have had different structures and forms in the past, that they will continue to evolve and develop, and that one of the things that we want to do in terms of learning about just, you know, what is it to be a man, what is it to be a woman, and so on, is to look at these epics themselves and at the remnants of them in our own being today, these various worldviews, these various epics that men and women have gone through are present today. Everybody's born at square one and goes through these various stages of development. And at each stage, what's masculine and what's feminine differs.
Okay, so what you're saying is that
I'm out differently in men and women.
Got it. And so depending on where I am in my life and, you know, whether I'm a teenager or the way I view the world in that way, then my role as a man and my in the way that I interact with women is going to come from that place, and that it's constantly fluid based on where I am developmentally.
That's right. And it has, and then developmentally is one of the main components that goes into the type of masculinity that I'm going to be expressing, and then also the biology, the biological components, and of course those change from the time of birth through a latent period, through puberty, through adolescence, and then into adulthood. And so hormonal differences are going to have a big role to play in my masculine or feminine expression. The type of cultural worldview that I'm raised in is going to have a big hand in how my particular gender roles play out. Am I brought up in a traditional values culture? Am I brought up in a modern culture? Am I brought up in a postmodern culture? Those will have a hand in it. And the techno-economic base of the culture itself. Am I in a foraging culture? Am I in a horticultural culture? Am I in an agrarian culture? Am I in an industrial culture? Or am I in an informational culture? Mm. And what we find looking at the roles of men and women in each of those epochs is that they're expressed differently. And the societies that are built around those are expressed differently.
Okay.
So one of the things, and all of these are still available to us in our own makeup today, we still have, if we look at worldviews, for example, the first guy that studied worldviews cross-culturally was the genius Gene Gebser, and he found about six major worldviews or value structures that humanity has developed through. And I like these because the single terms that he used for these epochs are kind of self-explanatory. The stages that he found were archaic, magic, mythic, rational, pluralistic, integral, and higher.
Mm-hmm.
And so even in today's world, men and women are born at an archaic stage of development and have archaic masculine and feminine modes. Then they move into masculine. Then they move into mythic, fundamentalist, traditional role values. Then they develop, if they continue to develop, into modern, rational, egoic, scientific, materialist masculinity and femininity. And then if they continue, they move into postmodern.
Can we
values,
take it?
The sort of,
yeah, can
the
we
sensitive
take,
man and the sensitive woman.
Right. Can we take a second and just like give an example for each one of those? I can remember when I was a kid that things were magical. Is that what you're talking about? How I'm interpreting the world as from that lens of a young person that the world's magical? Are we relating there?
Yes, exactly. And it has basically the magical worldview is that things are magically interwoven. And this has to do with word magic, and it's very, very common in religions like voodoo, where you have an image of the person is indistinguishable from the person themselves. So if you poke a pin into a doll or an image of the person you're trying to hurt, that will actually hurt the real person,
mm-hmm.
because the image of the person and the person are magically undistinguished. And then there's mythic modes, and mythic modes are just that. They have to do with myth, and they are the basis of the world's major religious narratives, and not contemplation, not meditation. That's an entirely different affair. But myths in terms of stories and narratives that humanity has told itself. And the values around these tend to be very fundamentalistic, very rigid. Men and women's roles are very, very defined and very, very rigid. So, and it's a classic patriarchal scheme where men's sexual roles and women's sexual roles are highly defined, and women are basically barefoot, pregnant, at home, where men are in charge of the public sphere and in charge of resources and are basically the power structure revolves around men. And so sexual roles do as well. Mm-hmm. And then we get to the modern era, and with modern stage of development and modern values, there's a dramatic change. Because all of a sudden, with the development of machines that do work for men and women, then the component of physical strength no longer becomes as important in defining roles. Mm. And so women all of a sudden can enter into the public sphere. Women can start to move out of the house, move out of being confined to the private sphere and move into the public sphere. So we see the invention of feminism. We see women starting to move into the workforce. We see a whole change in the relation of men and women and masculine and feminine. What does it mean to be a man? What does it mean to be a woman? And the values change dramatically. Particularly compared to the previous stage, which is the fundamentalistic stage, the traditional values. And if development continues and we get into a postmodern stage, which is one of the very most recent stages of development, and it's been around historically for about 30 or 40 years, what we find there is a complete change again, and masculine and feminine values become, in a sense, egalitarian. They're looked upon as no fundamental difference between them. There's no nothing, neither one of them is better than the other. There's an emphasis on the sensitive man, the caring man, the man who's in touch with his feminine side, just as there's an emphasis on the woman who is entering the workforce and has it all. And it's not just a mother, but is a CEO, head of a company, mm-hmm. and just as much power as men. And so these value structures are still present. There's still, any of us can tap in to these different stages of development. And then when we do, it's going to actually exert pressures and needs and desires and fantasies that are different in each case. And so there, it doesn't do much good to say, what does it mean to be a real man? You have to say, what does it mean to be a man in a foraging culture? What does it mean to be a man in an agrarian culture? Mm. What does it mean to be a man in a modern culture? And we find this even today in the United States, for example, the culture wars are wars between the latest three stages of development. They're wars between traditional values, modern values, and postmodern values. And the traditional values are still associated with agrarian modes of techno-economic societies. So we see traditional values largely in things like the Midwest, where there's still agrarian farming production. Mm-hmm. And those tend to be fundamentalistic. They believe in the Bible in a literal way, and men's role is defined as ruling over nature and ruling over women, and women's role is subservient to men, and that is a classic traditional values associated with agrarian structures. Whereas if you get to the go to the Northeast, which is a classic modern industrial culture, then men and women are looked at more in egalitarian forms. And looking upon men ruling over women is just looked upon as aghast. Nobody would think of that kind of value. But if you're in a traditional value structure, that's exactly the type of structure that you have to come to terms with. Mm-hmm. It's exactly going to define your masculinity, and it's exactly going to define your femininity. Mm-hmm. So these value structures and worldviews are still with us. They're still defining our sexuality. They're still a really important component of what anybody in search of their gender roles are trying to come to terms with their present gender needs to take these factors into account.
Yeah, we can't just reduce the gender thing to the biological or evolutionary impact of things. It's so far beyond that, what I hear you saying. And as you're talking about these things, I'm like, oh, he's talking about my grandmother right now. Oh, now I feel like he's talking, like, there's Hillary. And then there's just George Bush. And you're actually kind of putting them, as I can see visually, like how they stack up or with each other as in a form of development. They move from one stage to the next. And all of that is available to us. And it's all dependent upon what our world is like. If we're living in this agrarian culture, that's what's most important. That's where we get our cues from. And that affects how I relate to women.
Exactly. And so we do indeed have the biological components, and the biological components are factors that we do take into account. And so one of the things that's recently happened is there's been a renewal of interest in so-called evolutionary psychology. And so this is a psychology that looks at the differences between the typical male and typical female in terms of their hormones, for example, and in terms of their mating patterns in a Darwinian sense. And these are important. I'm not saying that these aren't important. They're actually really profound in terms of the effect that they exert on a man and on a woman in terms of their own sexual drives. But we are saying that these sexual drives will be interpreted according to these value structures that you're at. So, for example, the role of mating patterns in men and women. When a woman gets pregnant, there is no Darwinian advantage whatsoever for her to have sex with somebody else. She's already pregnant. Hmm. She's already passed on her seed, at least for the next 9 months. Going out and having sex isn't going to help her do more of that.
Mm-hmm.
And as a matter of fact, will probably hurt her because it will diminish the willingness of the child's father to support the woman.
Mm-hmm.
Because the man, if he's going to support the pregnant woman, has to know that it's his child, that his DNA is being passed on. And so it's the double standard, in other words, is very real and comes from biology. A man, on the other hand, even if he gets one woman pregnant, there's every reason for him to continue having sex, because he's the more women he gets pregnant, the more of his genetic material he's passed on.
Mm.
So there is indeed a difference in terms of profligacy and sexual desire, number of partners that are typically chosen by men versus women. And yet, those are part of the final configuration of one's sexuality and part of what will determine the actual desires that you're feeling. Because if a man has these desires, for example, to have a lot of sex with a lot of women, and he lives in a agrarian, fundamentalistic, traditional values culture and is brought up to believe in biblical values, for example, in a literal sense, then he is going to feel very, very uncomfortable with his sexual drives.
Mm-hmm.
And even though they're there, they're not going to be something that he's going to easily want to act on. He's going to feel a great deal of guilt and shame, and will the whole value structure that he's brought up in will act to curb his biology, to actually dampen it down, in some cases reverse it.
Mm-hmm.
On the other hand, if he gets into a modern role structure, then there's less resistance to having multiple sexual partners. And as a matter of fact, most modern values will go ahead and say it's fine to have as many sexual partners as you want. And so here, the modern value structure combines with biology to produce men who are really open to and having a great deal of sex. Unless there are other problems, like their own individual psychology or their own particular neurosis. So it's basically looking at several factors, and an integral view would maintain that we want to look at all of these factors and see a great deal of importance in all of them, and not just choose one, not just say, okay, it's just evolutionary psychology, and it's just that men are profligate and women aren't, and that's all you have to come to terms with, because you also have to come to terms with the actual type of society you're living in. You have to come to terms with the value structure or worldview that you were brought up in, and that you're the stage of development that you're at there. And so putting all of these factors together gives you a more comprehensive view, gives you a way to come to terms with what you're feeling sexually in your own body. Because what you are feeling sexually in your own body is determined at least by these psychological, biological, cultural, and social factors. And in many cases, diametrically different.
Right.
Stage to stage.
And so a guy coming from an integral perspective, he may feel that like, oh God, I've got this desire, but I have this shame. It's not right. It doesn't jive with my cultural or my own personal belief systems. But a guy coming from an integral perspective can take a step back and say, where are these messages coming from? Oh, I've got the message coming from below the belt that I need to have sex more. I've got the message coming from my society or cultural surroundings that say I should not, and blah, blah, blah. And then I imagine he's got more choice at that point. He just has more awareness of, like, I'm not going to let one trump the other or one dominate the other. Is that the end goal of an integral perspective?
Well, that's certainly part of it, yes, is to look at my present desires and my present awareness and the my own sexual behavior, and to look at these different dimensions, these different components that are going into this sexual drive and what's making it up and where it comes from, why it's there, why I'm feeling what I'm feeling. And that gives you a capacity to indeed step back and take a look at where one's present drives and needs and desires and fantasies are coming from. And then knowing that, you can start to work with them. If there can be a great deal of conflict, for example, if you're raised particularly in a traditional Christian, Catholic, Southern Baptist upbringing, and you are still basically have those values that are part of your makeup, then those impulses below the belt, as you put it, are indeed going to cause a great deal of shame and a great deal of anxiety.
Mm-hmm.
And so tracking that is an important way to see where that's coming from. It won't just do to say, well, because of evolutionary psychology, men are going to have these much greater sexual drives, so you shouldn't worry about it. It's just the way it is, and, you know, just deal with it.
Just chop it off.
Because there are real factors in your psyche that are going against those sexual drives and are really going up against them and internally broadcasting shame and guilt for any of these drives.
Mm-hmm.
And so knowing where that comes from is going to let you also not feel that you're just an erotic mess.
I totally agree, and it's wonderful, because then I get to take the lens and, like, well, if there is a pathology here, is there something to address on the psychological front? Do I need to go do a certain therapy or a workshop around this to create more spaciousness and freedom here? Or do I just need to let go of some old cultural or religious beliefs that just don't serve me anymore? I'm getting is, like, from this perspective, now I can take action. I can be in service of greater freedom and love in my life.
Exactly. And what all of this is going for, basically, is an increase in consciousness, an increase in awareness, an increase in one's capacity to stand back, look at one's present configuration, where these drives are coming from, what's producing them. If you're actually sort of theoretically interested in these, you can look at it historically if you want to. It's a fascinating story how men and women's roles have changed so dramatically, going from horticultural to agrarian, for example. Horticultural means that the society's basic food substance is produced by horticulture. The difference between horticulture and agrarian is that horticultural, the seeds are planted with a simple stick or handheld hoe, whereas in the agrarian, it's a heavy, heavy animal drawn, usually using oxen or cows or cattle. So in terms of how women then are involved in horticulture and agrarian, in horticultural cultures, about 80% of the foodstuff is produced by women, because a woman can easily use a little hoe or digging stick even while she's pregnant. But in an agrarian society, a woman, when she's pregnant, can't draw a heavy animal-drawn plow. They have much higher rates of miscarriage. Mm. So it's to their Darwinian advantage not to be part of the public sphere. They're not oppressed by men when it comes to why they aren't part of the public sphere and why they remain in the private sphere. The idea that men are nasty pigs that are out oppressing women and keeping them at home and taking away the public sphere, it's just categorically incorrect. It's a co-creation, a co-choice made by the women themselves to let the men do that heavy work and the women stay at home.
Right.
So that's a big difference in sexual modes right there, and how the sexual configuration of the human body makes such a big difference depending on nature, depending on what is required from nature in order to make a living, in order to survive. And so going back and looking at that is also a way to free men up from a lot of the guilt that had been imposed on them by, well, historians, to feminists, to well-meaning men and women who are attempting to understand sexual differentiation in the workplace, but don't really look at all of these factors and look at just one or two of them, and then reach some very, very truncated and partial and fragmented conclusions, and conclusions that are really wrong, and that end up painting men as pigs and women as sheep.
Right. So, yeah, these people are taking a very narrow view instead of this broader, more integral view, and they're deducting from that, you know, oh, wait a second, these guys are being jerks and they're pushing women out of the job. But it's really like, it's more from a practical perspective. Women are going to lose their children, especially in this horticultural epoch, as you're talking about, that it's they're going to lose the children. It's from practicality, not from
exactly.
Oppression.
Exactly, and it's a co-creation of the men and women. And so the women end up then choosing not to get involved in heavy labor that leads to miscarriage and leads to a loss, well, simply, which is psychologically extremely difficult, but just according to biological Darwinian terms, keeps a woman out of the gene pool race.
Right.
So it's to her Darwinian advantage not to do that. And it's a decision imposed not by men on women, but by nature on women, if anything, or women on women.
Yeah.
And so in horticultural affairs, where women can fairly easily use a stick or a little hand-drawn hoe, about, say, 75-80% of foodstuffs are produced by women, and women tend to participate in public life, and the deities of horticultural societies, about two-thirds of them are female. And as a matter of fact, when you find a great goddess, great mother deity, it is almost entirely and solely found in horticultural societies. Now, when there's a shift to agrarian modes of production and a heavy animal-drawn plow is required, women opt out of that. Men tend to move in and take over that physically demanding heavy work. Women tend to move into dominating the private sphere. Woman is in charge of the household and of any servants that there might be. And this, again, is not oppression. This is a selection made by men and women.
Right.
And the shit job actually goes to the males. Quality of life studies by Janet Chaffetz, for example, a major feminist researcher, finds that the quality of life is significantly lower in the patriarchy for men. So it's a series of arrangements in society that are not really the product of male oppression. Because again, in order to even have that view, you have to assume that women are either stupider or weaker than men in order to be oppressed. You can't be as strong and as smart and oppressed. So it ends up defining a woman as limited, as defective, as weaker, as less intelligent than a man right off the bat. It defines her as a victim instead of as a powerful co-creator of the structures of each of these types of societal structures. And then we find when we move to the modern era that there is less demand for physical labor in order to survive. And so there's less pressure for the male advantage in physical strength. And we start to find women entering the public sphere for the first time. We find the liberation movements. We find women given the vote. And all of these are in part directly the result of the fact that physical strength is no longer required, as in the agrarian farming age, in order to have survival. So again, by taking a bigger picture and looking at all of the factors that go in to gender roles, we get out of narrower pictures that have just, you know, just select one set of values, a modern feminist set of values, for example, and whenever a previous epoch doesn't have the modern or postmodern feminist sense of values, the feminist just assumes it's because women are oppressed. And that's a horrible view of women, because it's assuming that they are weaker or stupider or are not as smart as the modern feminist and just can't figure out what a true set of values should be.
Right.
Whereas given those circumstances, that's exactly what they should be doing. And it's a very smart move by the women to pass on their Darwinian material.
Got it.
So again, a little integral view helps, and it helps lessen the guilt on men and the shame on women.
Beautiful. I'm all for that. You know, now I was just reading in Fortune magazine, there's this article in there about the women in these days, women are playing a bigger role professionally and more men are actually losing their jobs because of it. Is this new? Are we coming around? Like, is the pendulum swinging to the other side? Is this healthy? Is this not healthy? What are your thoughts on that?
Well, I think partly what we do have to do is get just a much clearer view on why and how society differentiates gender roles. Now, traditionally, sex, the word sex and sexual topics are used to refer to the biological dimension of men and women. So the amount of testosterone I have in my body is a matter of is a sexual issue. Whereas gender is how a society defines masculine and feminine. So gender roles are much more open to cultural learning and cultural rearrangement, whereas sex is much more determined by biological evolution and Darwinian, neo-Darwinian factors.
Okay.
And one of the first things is just simply looking at the evolution of men and women, the evolution of gender roles, and looking at, from an integral view, and seeing these many different aspects that go into determining what is a gender role in any given society, and the types of roles that are allowed, and how we should educate men and women for the roles in society. And what we went from is the modern structure, that looks upon men and women as being essentially equivalent and started to open up places in the public sphere for women to step into on an equal basis, and gave women the vote, and started to treat women in every way as equal to men. But then that modern structure looked back and said, wait a minute, why didn't the previous structure, why were women always at home and men had all the positions of power? That must have been oppression. That must have been something horrible that men were doing to women. And then spent a whole generation trying to do history as a history of oppression, as a history of women getting nothing but oppressed by men, and taking out the role that women themselves played in selecting those roles, and the important part that women themselves played in co-creating the structure of societies. And of course, it's not to say that oppression doesn't exist. Of course it exists. But you have to look at overall the reasons and determine what's a case of real oppression versus what's the case of actually a co-selection, a co-creation process. And so what happened in the modern era is that we went a little bit overboard indeed, as you said. And what happened is that any advantages in the public sphere where there was a male was assumed to be due to oppression. And so we swung to a little bit the opposite direction and started to sort of get a quota type of system going where we would force the number of positions available to be held equally by men and women. And what we did was modern and postmodern structure ended up misunderstanding the traditional values structure, why it was there, why it originally started, why it was a conscious creation of females during the agricultural eras, and not to blame men and to basically get into a position where men are thrown out of jobs and women are privileged. So we are going through a period like that right now where we are going a little bit too far overboard, and women are being given positions not based on merit, but based simply on the fact that they're women. And that can have a modest amount of help in terms of redressing the actual number of genders in each position. But it very, very, very quickly becomes a deeply unfair practice. And it's unfair to the men that are more qualified, and it's unfair to the women who are given the jobs, and everybody knows they're given the jobs solely because they're female. So what we want to do is really start educating, start at, you know, grade one, and educating males and females to assume that a female can adopt any role in society that a male can, and treat their roles equally and fairly, and then let the best person, male or female, get the job. But we certainly do have to start by re-educating society to see that boys and girls can each hold down positions of power and are equally qualified to do so. And then to allow biological differences that are there to exist, and not to try to override those. And it's still true that there are certain things that men have a proclivity for that women don't. And we go all the way back to the earliest societies, and we see that men have a tendency to engineering and mathematics, for example. And even in today's modern world, there are more women now going into medical schools. There are more women in law schools, but there are still more men in engineering and mathematical schools. So there are some differences, and we can't just gloss over those by forced quotas.
It's like they're trying to force a 50-50, we're going to make everything fair here, and we're actually going to force something which actually goes against the natural nature, the natural order of things. Is that what you're saying?
Well, it's certainly forcing a value structure that we find occurring only at one major stage of development. And so the postmodern value structure for example, which is a radically egalitarian structure, is essentially the structure that is being foisted in these circumstances and is being forced on all stages of development. So we don't understand that men and women going through the fundamentalist stage, the traditional stage, the mythic stage, are going to have a different set of values. They are going to value male and female roles differently. And they like it that way. The women going through those stages prefer it that way. They're not being brainwashed. They're not stupid. They're not sheep. They're highly intelligent women going through a stage of development that looks at sexual roles in this fashion, and typically then embraces, you know, family values and values that place as much value on female roles of motherhood as on female roles of CEO.
Mm-hmm.
And it's their choice, and they should be allowed to have that choice and not have just the postmodern egalitarian value structure forced on all of the other major stages of development. That's what we don't want to happen.
Got it. Got it. Let's switch gears a little bit now as we kind of start to wrap up the conversation a bit. We've only been talking about gender, male-female dynamics through history from an integral perspective, but there's politics, there's spirituality, there's ecology, there's anything and everything fits under this huge integral umbrella. And I'm curious, from your perspective, what are some of the impacts that you see in the everyday guy's life that, oh, I discovered integral, now this is possible for me?
Yeah, well, one of the main things is people that start studying integral approaches to the human being in the world start to discover potentials and capacities in themselves that they didn't know they had. And the integral approach opens up just an enormous number of avenues and paths that one can take in life and in one's own growth and development. And this is because integral maps of the human being are comprehensive maps. They're maps that are drawn on virtually every other map that's existed. And they include contemplative pre-modern stages of development. They look at stages of meditation and include those and look at the very capacity of meditation and what that can do and how that changes one's awareness and how that can bring an enormous amount of freedom and transcendence and openness, and that there are then ways, techniques, practice techniques that one can do to tap in to these dimensions in a human being. There are practices that one can do, meditation, for example, that allows one to get in touch with much deeper states of consciousness, contemplative states of consciousness, spiritual states of consciousness, flow states of consciousness that, for example, are extremely beneficial in enhancing one's sports capacity. There's a whole sexual side to states of consciousness and the use of tantric sexuality to increase both one's simple pleasure in sex, but also increase the power, the depth of spiritual modes of awareness, spiritual states of consciousness. There are techniques that enhance relationship and capacity to be aware of all of these factors in relationship, and therefore have more sensitive, deeper, more long-lasting, more caring relationships that one gets into. So what we're doing is, of course, we always remember that the map is not the territory, and we don't confuse those.
Right.
But at the same time, you don't want to have a completely screwed-up map of the territory.
Mm-hmm.
You want to have an accurate, comprehensive, holistic, full-blown map of human possibilities. And that map can serve as a guide to any territory of action, then, that a human being does. And that's from work to play to spirituality across the board. And so an integral approach simply opens up the possibilities, and then by showing you those, gives you an enormous number of greater choices that you can make about what to do with your own life.
Yeah, the impact it's had on me, I echo all of that, but it just became a one-stop shop. Here was this comprehensive map. Here are the best practices based on the people in this community that are checking all this stuff out that have the great. These best practices have the greatest impact for me, whether it's in sex, relationship, physical fitness, building more awareness through meditation, all of these things that it was like, oh shit, I don't have to go and be the expert on everything. Here's this place where in this methodology and this map that shows me how it all fits together and how it shows me how the differences in values from one practice to the other so I can make a more informed choice about what it is that I want to do in my life.
Well, that's well put. Well put, and in a sense, it is sort of a one-stop shopping, and it's a one-stop shopping that it doesn't, it's one-stop not because it narrows choices down, but it's one-stop because it has all the choices that we're aware of in one building, in
exactly.
one place,
exactly.
in one restaurant, and all on one menu, and you get that one menu, and you've really, really got the bases covered.
Yeah.
And that's exactly what we're trying to do.
Yeah, what I appreciate most about is that you've done this incredible work of laying out the map of the territory with all of your books and all of the work that you've done over the last few decades. And now it's finally time that we actually get some tools and products that help us to get into the territory, how to actually be in the territory with this knowledge, not just walking around with it stuck in my head, but actually get to have it actually impact all areas of my life rather than just how I think about it.
Exactly. And that's where we draw on, again, the community of those who are using the map and using it in real life circumstances. We have an academic journal that has over 26 human disciplines all done in an integral fashion. So we have from integral economics, integral law, integral art, integral politics, integral psychology, integral education, and so on. And you can find information about that on the website as well. And that is indeed people taking this framework, taking this comprehensive map, and actually applying it in real life circumstances. So whether that's an actual profession, or whether that's work and play, sexuality, relationships.
Beautiful. I love that there's just a wide variety of ways that I can apply myself depending on what I'm most interested in. If it's just something I want a daily practice, great, I've got that. If I want to go a full academic route and really walk and talk this stuff in the world and further it into education, I can go that route. And if I want to just find a community of other people that are like-minded and want to share this stuff, this site has it as well. So this is integrallife.com we're talking about, correct? Integral Life?
Yes.
Okay.
And you can start getting the starter kit at myilp.com.
MyILP as in integral life practice.com.
Right.
Okay. Wonderful. Well, Ken, anything else before we wrap it up?
That's it. It's been great talking with you, Tripp.
It's been good to catch up with you too, man. I really appreciate you taking the time to come on the show today. I'm very passionate about your work. It's impacted me greatly, and I'm glad that we found a way to have you on the show and share it with others out there.
Fantastic, buddy.
To learn more about integral theory and put it into practice in your life, subscribe to integrallife.com. Use the coupon code MAN, as in MAN, and get $5 off your monthly subscription rate. Thanks for listening.